Let me remind you the things that I left over from last time. So improving the main injectivity result for the attenuated transform. So there were some claims that I said I was going to explain, and here's a list of them. So the first one is the existence of holomorphic integrating factors in the case of a simple surface when you consider a scalar one form on the simple surface. Yeah, so the claim is that you give yourself a scalar one form, and there's a smooth and holomorphic fiber-wise. So remember, the definition of holomorphic had to do, we had a Fourier series expansion, and we just said that a function was holomorphic in the fiber-wise direction if we only have if all the negative Fourier coefficients were equal to zero. And that was very important to sort of gauge away the further attenuation that we used. The further attenuation was used in the L2 identity, which is stated in the second bit, to control essentially the curvature of this term. So the fact that we have a simple surface, we have non-contrary points, as I'm also going to explain, gives us control on the sign of this, but we have very little control on this for an arbitrary connection. So the sort of key idea of the proof was to sort of modify A by a one-parameter connection related with a primitive of the area form over which we had a sort of control of the sign, basically. So we were able to control the sign of this, of everything that was involved here, and that more or less, with some manipulations, gave us the theorem in the end. So these were the items. At some point I made use of a slightly more refined version of this when you have a connection A where the only change is that, you put plus star of A here and plus star of A here. And then Adrian asked this question about whether one can give an interpretation of this, and then, well, Nico had an answer. Then Slava asked me a little bit more at the end of the last lecture. So then Alex also asked me at some point whether one could prove this using some special coordinates. So in the end, I realized that I didn't have a very good proof. So I'm going to give you what I think is I wouldn't call it a new proof, but I'm going to give you a coordinate-free proof of this. And I think coordinate-free, and I'm going to try to explain to Adrian, I think, see if we can finally be happy with this. Yeah? Yes. So I think I'm quite happy with this. It should all fit in one board. Okay? And it uses some new sort of operators, which I think I was going to introduce tomorrow, but I might as well bring them in today because they're very relevant. Okay? So I'm actually going to prove this. So, okay. So, the proof of the bracket. So the proof that appears in Pesto-Neumann uses a definition of the Hilbert transform via an integral using the Cotangent function, yeah, some principal value integral. The other proof that I knew, which is the one that I was comfortable with, is you take isothermal coordinates, and there is a formula for x, and then you just go and check that it works, which is a bit of brute force. I think the one I'm going to do, I think it does justice to Miko's comment yesterday about, and we're going to see clearly that there's only interaction with the Fourier modes at degree 0, 1, and minus 1, because that's really what's going to happen. Okay, so. Then let me just really, so I'm not going to compute this bracket, but a closely related one, which is easier. So let me just remind you that that with the definition of the Hilbert transform that we gave, if we have a function u, suddenly we get this, yeah? So really the Lie bracket that I'm going to compute is the Lie, the bracket that I'm going to compute is just this one, which is going to be a lot easier. And I'm not going to compute this one. This is where the proof differs from the previous ones. I'm going to do something with x first. Yeah? So this is the one we want to compute. And what I'm going to do with x first is I'm going to deduce two operators, eta plus and eta minus, which are defined in the following way. So as you remember, yesterday this x perp was defined using just a bracket of x and v. Okay, now these operators are very nice. Well, obviously, one decouples x into eta plus eta minus. Yeah, you'll see why the plus and the minus, of course, you can explain it because of this, but there's another thing that they do, which is very good. And obviously, if you do IXPERP, you get them by doing eta plus minus eta minus. Yep. Okay, now what's the deal with these operators? These operators were introduced by Guillemin and Kashtan in a paper which I like very much. In a paper in 1980 in Topology, or what it used to mean, it doesn't exist topology anymore. I don't know if it does exist. Does anyone know if it exists? I mean, the board of topology migrated to the Journal of Topology, but Elsevier might keep it still running. Well, one's called the Journal of Topology. This used to be called just plain topology. I mean, topology. Anyway, so they define these operators. And what is the deal with these operators? Well, I mean, so remember that we had a decomposition. Let's just use K. So, okay, well, I mean, I'm going to do everything with infinity functions here. So I might as well then call HK, the intersection of HK with infinity. Okay, and the key property of these operators is that eta plus raises degree by 1, and eta minus shifts degree down by 1. This is absolutely obvious to check from the bracket relations. So we had another bracket here that was that x was equals to minus x power of v. So with these bracket relations and the definition of eta, there's an analogous bracket relation between eta plus and v and eta minus and v. And from that, it is needed to check that if you have a function that has degree k in the Fourier expansion, it's mapped to one that has degree k plus 1. Yes, so this is really just from the bracket relation. So then the geodesic vector field gets decomposed into this. So this is why the geodesic flow acting on a function, let's say an omega k, goes up by 1 and down by 1 in general. It has sort of two components. Okay, so really what one has to do then is really just compute this now, which is very easy. So let's compute that one. And then with eta minus, and then we add them. That's all we do. Okay? And which one did I do first? Yes, eta plus. So should be very simple. So I would like to figure out what is this applied to a function uk that belongs to omega k. Okay, and then you just say, well, let's write it out and just look at it. And then it just all follows. So let me just then perhaps do this. So, okay, so now you say, let's see, what happens if k is less than or equal than minus 2, let's say. Well, if k is less than or equal than minus 2, this one shifts it up by 1. Yeah, but it never goes beyond minus 1. So then this one eats it up. Yeah. So we just say, I just split it into three cases. K equal to minus 2. So let's just write it like this. And then this is equal to 0 minus 0. All right. So now there is a special case minus 1. So let's see what happens in minus 1. So eta plus brings it to 0, to degree 0. When you apply this, you just get u 0. So which means that this is just eta plus of u minus 1. And what does this one do? Well, if you have something in minus 1, this eats it up. So it's just that. Okay? Great. Now the other important degree is zero, and if you compute it at zero, what do you get? Well, you just get, I mean, so eta, let's just make sure that I look at the right one, yes. So eta plus of u zero brings it to degree one, and this, what it does is twice that. So this is twice eta plus of u zero, and then this is, since this is on degree zero, this just picks up u zero. So it's minus eta plus of u zero. So this is eta plus of u zero. Okay, and then similarly you check very simply that if k is greater than or equal to 1, this is just 0. Yeah, you, this is 0 because you get twice that and minus twice that when you cancel. Yeah. Yeah. So therefore, the conclusion is, okay, so it's going to be more than one board, but I mean, yes. Yeah, so then the conclusion is that if you apply that to an arbitrary U, the only thing you get is this and that. And now, I hope you will agree that one can say similarly, if you do this, the same sort of degree of complexity with eta plus, you get minus eta minus u zero minus eta minus u one. So if you do a single calculation. Okay, you add them up and you get the one you want. You do this applied to x, and you just get, well, you see, this is, well, let's write it down so you can see it clearly in its full glory. This is that being applied to u0, and then the other one is just eta plus being applied to u1 minus, okay. And then just from the definition, directly from the definition, you recognize that this is pi x perp applied to u0. So this one is pi x perp. So this is exactly what Mikko was saying yesterday. What you see from this calculation is that, I mean, there's interaction only in degree 0, 1, and 0, minus 1, and 1 when you do it for the eta minus. Yeah? This is that one. And this, well, that's exactly pi x perp of u applied to 0. Yeah? Because the only components of x perp in degree 0 are exactly this. That's the end of it. So it's very soft, the formula for the bracket, I mean, really. It's really, really tangible, you know, nothing more, I mean, just the brackets. Great, so, yeah, everyone happy? Okay, so, actually, I mean, this proof makes the formula that I wrote down for a connection absolutely obvious, too, because if you add a connection, and you have to replace x by x plus a, there are analogous operators here. You split the connection into an a1 and a minus 1 component, and there are two operators, which also raise and lower things in the end. Exactly the same thing. Okay, so I think I want to prove now the existence of these holomorphic integrating factors. Now, proof of the proposition. Okay, so The idea of something like this is, again, to use this somehow. Yeah. So we want to get something holomorphic. So why not try to apply x to something of this form, the identity minus I h of some function, and the function that we put here is going to be determined by, you know, solving that equation. Very simple minor thing too. Yeah? So let's try. Basically, let's try. W to be of the form identity plus IH being applied to some W tilde, which I don't know yet, but it will be determined by the equation that we're trying to solve. So we are trying to solve the equation x omega equals a. So here the bracket comes again. Yeah. So you do x of the identity plus IH applied to omega tilde. Let's compute that. So this is what we want. Okay, and here we use the bracket formula. So if we compute this with the bracket formula, what we get is something like this. Okay, so you get x of omega, x of omega tilde plus I, and here I have, let's put it like that. And now I use the bracket formula, so I get minus h x omega tilde, and now comes minus expert omega tilde 0. Minus expert omega tilde 0. Okay? I did the bracket relation on the holomorphic forms now. This is not necessarily holomorphic. Oh. The one that I'm trying to, you know, force it to be holomorphic. So I'm using the bracket relation on that. Yes. Be a plus. Ah, yes. Thanks. It's going to go away in a minute. Thanks. Yeah. Sorry. Ah, very good. Ah, but that one I can answer. These are like the D and D bar operators. In fact, if you make, so this requires a little bit of thinking, but it's not too bad. But each omega k, so the functions of degree k, can be identified with sections on the tensor power of the canonical line bundle. And there, these operators become, up to conjugation, they become the D and D bar operators of Talbot. So the intuition is they are Cauchy-Riemann operators. That's the answer. And that, I think, I can say that with conviction. These are Cauchy-Riemann operators in, yes. This way is present in here. If you want to read this paper, that's what they come up with. And again, if you want, and write down expressions in isothermal coordinates for this, you can see it actually as a sort of D bar and a conjugation, very similar to the conjugation that Mikko had today with the Laplace operator, that you're conjugating with this weight, with these functions, e to the phi, whatever. Here they get conjugated by some weight that has to do with the conformal factor of your metric, basically. Yeah, so it's kind of very nice. I mean, the geodesic flows, this is, I mean, coming back to, I think it was Alexis at some point that asked about cohomology. Yeah, so the operator D, everyone knows, splits as D plus D bar. So this is the analog of the level of the geodesic flow. You replace T by the geodesic flow and then splits into the analogs, which are eta and eta plus. Yeah, so I would call this, so just to continue on that question again, and so this is really the, so this is a dynamical version of this. Sorry, Arthur. Right. So then, this is just the commutator formula. So if we are now lucky and we choose, you know, the omega tilde such that it is an integral, so x omega tilde is equal to zero. So if then this sort of x omega becomes now this goes away, and then even more. So if x of this is zero, and then we are able to choose omega even. So let's suppose all that, because all that actually you can do that, you can accomplish that. Then that goes away. That yeah, even in the sense, yes, I mean, oh, sorry, thanks. Maybe I should just say that. It seems second nature to me now, but even in the sense that you only have even Fourier coefficients. I'm sorry? No. Even in the sense that you only have even Fourier coefficients. Yes. Or in the sense that if you change V by minus V, the function doesn't change. So even equals zero odd Fourier coefficients. Okay, so if we have that, then that goes away. Because if omega tilde is even, then this x plus this x perp, remember just from the formulas, from the eta plus and eta minus, maps even to odd, so that goes away. So you only end up picking this term. So ends up being just simply minus I, and this is what we want to be A. Okay. So somehow we need to find a first integral of the geodesic flow, which is even, and solving that equation. Right, and that's essentially the surjectivity of the adjoint of the wave transform. So let me explain. So what you do is first you sort of, you know, you gauge away stuff in A. So if A is a one form, you can use a Hodge decomposition and write A as, let's say, dr plus star operator of dg. So this is just a Hodge decomposition. We own a disk. So okay, so we own a disk. We can certainly do that. So one thing that we see right away is that, you know, we can forget about this term, yeah? Because if I have the A, I can just simply shift. So for functions on the base, so remember that for functions, so this R will be a function of only of X. So on the unit sphere bundle, VR is the same thing as XR. So if you're trying to solve the equation X omega equals A, this is the same thing as, you know, solving the equation because if R depends only on position, you know, if you get that one holomorphic, omega minus I is also holomorphic. So you gauge that away. And then the other thing that you realize now is that this is exactly the same thing as X perp of G. Why is that? Well, in the same way as, you know, if you have a function that depends on position, X gives you D, the X perp gives you star D. I mean, there's a kind of easy way to see that just by using the definition of X perp. So if you do X perp G using the bracket, XV VX, you just get XVG minus VXG. And since G only depends on position, that goes away. And this is just minus V of DG. And minus V, you can check that is applying minus V is like apply is exactly the same thing as applying the star operator. I sort of explained that yesterday, essentially. But remember that if you apply V to a one form, to something that depends on x and b, this is just doing the derivative at theta equal to 0. And this is so, that's just that. Because the star operator in one form just rotates by pi over 2. So, okay, so therefore, after that sort of little bit of geometry there, or just, I mean, not much. What you see now is that the the only thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to find, so we need to find omega tilde even with, which is an integral of the geodesic flow, and such that the component, so we need to be equal to x dot g. So for this, it suffices then to have that. Okay, so finally what we need is, so it's been reduced to, so it's been reduced to finding an integral of the geodesic flow, this even, in fact, I mean, it doesn't even have to be even, I mean, so I think it's, I forgot a hat somewhere. Equals IG. So in fact, the sort of requirement of being even is not necessary. If you just find, an omega hat, you take the even part, and that will do the trick. Yeah, split into even and odd, and that. Okay. But now this is exactly the surjectivity of the adjoint of the X-ray transform. So let me explain. So this is surjectivity of the adjoint of the ray transform, the usual ray transform, not attenuated. Yes. Yeah. You, so you can get rid of the R. This was the argument to get rid of the R. So you can forget about the R, and then all that you're then trying to, and then, really what you're trying to get is that. X of omega minus R is equal to that, but according to the calculation, all we need then is to check that X perp minus I X perp of omega tilde 0 equals A.
Alright.
Yeah, so this is what I wrote here. So this is exactly the same thing as the claim of surjectivity of this, because right? Because, I mean, the... So here I am referring to the usual ray transform on functions. So if you have a sort of symphinity function on M, this is just the integral from 0 to tau of xv along all the geodesics. Yeah? So this is f of... yeah, that's the usual ray transform on functions. Okay? And if you compute, I'm not going to do this sort of calculation, but I mean, if you do the calculation and you compute the adjoint, this goes to, this is the usual sort of notation, which I will explain in a minute. The adjoint, I0 goes from functions into functions of the boundary, well, let's say, in principle, continuous functions there. So the adjunct goes the other way, but if you restrict to good functions here, namely, so these are precisely the smooth functions in delta plus, which give you smooth solutions of equation x omega equal to zero. Yeah, because I mean, once you have a function on delta plus, you can extend it as a first integral trivially by just saying, you know, if you want to know what the function is here, you just define as the value just going back. Yeah. So the issue is whether those are going to be smooth. Well, not all are going to be smooth, but there is a subset of those which are smooth, which is smooth, and this subset is denoted by that. And the adjoint going from here to there is that if you have a function, so if I give a function here, this h, and the notation that one usually uses for this is h5, this is the first integral, the adjoint has that formula. So this is the first integral. First integral of the geodesic flow, such that the value of this on the boundary, on the plus boundary, coincides with h. Okay, and this zero is, you know, you take the average. So this is the formula that you get for the adjoint, and the surjectivity of this was proved by Pestov and Ullmann in that paper. So this is proved. So. Subjectivity. So this map subjective like this tool, which I'm not going to explain, that would take me, I mean, but it essentially follows from the injectivity of the ray the usual ray transform, and the fact that they use a microlocal analysis and prove that I zero star is an elliptic operator, so on. Okay, so that's exactly what one wants, because I give you, you know, you give me an arbitrary infinity function, and I can find a first integral hitting that one, hitting the zero Fourier mode. Okay, I don't know if it's even a rod, but then, you know, I pick up the even part, and that's it. That's still an integral. If you have a function that is an integral by the geodesic flow, you know, even a rod part comes with. That's the proof, really. So the difficult thing somehow in the proof is here. Somehow, yeah? It's been in the key fact. So if the rest here is, I mean, it's just again the bracket relation, some Hodge composition. Okay, so there is a similar result. If rather than considering a one form, you consider a function a that only depends on x. So that was proved a little bit earlier by Mikko and Gunther in an earlier paper. And that relies, if I understand it correctly, on the surjectivity of the adjoint of the ray transform, but not on functions, but on one forms. Well, you can see. Yeah. So if you want holomorphic integrating functions for one forms, you have to go to surjectivity of ray transform on zero forms, and then they split. If you want integrating factors for functions, you have to go to surjectivity results for ray transform on one forms. Okay. Great. So I just have to do the next two things. Okay. Now, as I said before, I mean, maybe this is the right moment to put so So let A be a unitary connection. In M, yeah, in the bundle M cross N, does there exist a smooth and holomorphic function R from SN into the unitary group such that so this is open and greater than or equal than 2. Yeah, for n equals 1 is what we just proved, because once you get the omega, for n equals 1, the r is just e to the omega. Or e to the minus omega? E to the minus. Yeah, so if you differentiate e to the minus omega, this is certainly true. And if your one form is a unitary one form, namely it is just I times a real form, then the omega comes up to being I times a real function, and then this becomes a genuine function on the circle, which is U1. Okay? So this is the existence of holomorphic integrating factors for connections. So we thought some time ago that this was the way to go about solving the problem. The problem is that we couldn't prove the existence of these holomorphic things. Because of the obvious usual thing with exponential maps of a matrix, when you differentiate it, it's not what you think it's going to be. Well, yeah, it's non-commutative stuff, so. Frankly, I don't know if there is an application of this at the moment, because we have already solved the problem with this sort of alternative way that I explained yesterday. But, you know, just for the sake of harmony in the world of mathematical ideas, one would like to know whether this is true or not. I mean, morally it should be true. Yeah? Has to be true. Okay. Okay, so the pistol identity. Right, so basically, let me convince you of a formula for A equal to 0, and then I sort of mumble a few words, and then you'll see that somehow there has to be a formula like that for A different from 0. Okay, so what's the idea? The idea is exactly to do what Nico was explaining a couple of lectures ago. So you introduce an operator, which is P equals Vx. You look at that operator, yeah? That appears in the, so let me just show the pistol for A equals to 0 is XVU squared minus KVU VU equals BXU square minus XQ square, and it's important here that the function vanishes on the boundary, because otherwise we'll be picking up boundary terms. So all these operators are volume preserving. Yep. So what that means essentially is that if you do the inner product of a function that vanishes on the boundary with another function, they become skew symmetric. Yeah, is a volume preserving. That's simply because, I mean, if you write down this in terms of integrals, this is just, you know, XUG, and the other integral is UXG with respect to the volume form. That. So, if you differentiate this, it becomes suddenly XUG plus UXG. Yeah? But if it is volume preserving, if you integrate a full derivative, it's zero if there are no boundary terms. So if the term at the boundary vanishes, which it does if U vanishes, essentially. Okay? So then this becomes true by volume preservation. So the same with X-perp and the same with V. So formally, the P star ends up being XV. Yeah, because you sort of flip them and they are both skew symmetric, so therefore they become symmetric. Okay, but that's the norm of PU squared, so I can write the identity that we are trying to prove as PU squared minus KVU VU, P star, equals PU squared minus XU squared. Along with this guy today. Okay, so so now you use kind of general nonsense. I mean, this is the norm of P square is the norm of P star U square plus commutator. Let's see if I write it which way I want it. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of trivially true. I mean, this is star PPU U minus PP star UU. So you move this to the other side, yeah, and you get, okay, which means that I got it wrong. I got it right. No. Okay, so what this suggests is that the only thing that you have to do is to compute this commutator. Okay, which is a commutator of the form, you know, XV VX. Okay, you go and you compute it. We have everything to compute the commutators. We have all the brackets that we possibly need. Yep. You go and you compute it and you get, I'm not going to do a calculation of that, so. You just get, after you do some work, you get you get minus x squared plus v kv, so after some calculation. Yes, because you can see it coming, this is going to be xv vx. And then, yes, so you can replace the XV by VX X-perp, and then the X-perp appears and commutes with X, and then the curvature appears. Okay, so this is just a calculation. Okay, so you're done. That's the proof, because now what happens is that if you put everything together, this term pops up, because when you do something like X squared UU, this is minus XU XU. And that produces this term. And we're done. And then you move the V to the other side and you arrange, you collect, basically, rearrange. So, and so this was Mikko's proof of the Pestle identity. I think this is great. This is really the best way to see this, I think, now. I mean, this becomes really transparent, I hope. Okay, if you have a connection, It's exactly the same thing. You just replace, you have to work a little harder. Just, you know, you replace x by x plus a, and then, you know, the work will come in computing this commutator. They're going to be derivatives of a connection. And then if you do it carefully, the curvature of the connection pops up, which is now very believable. If the Gaussian curvature pops up, you know, you go to second order. What you know, sorry, to first order and the connection, differentiate connection once, what are you going to get? I mean, it has to be the curvature. So that's really the way one proves best way. And since I'm here, I can also maybe explain very briefly how this gives you immediately injectivity on functions. So if you've never seen a proof of why, so how would you prove then that the X-ray transform is injective on simple function, on functions, on a simple surface? Well, it will go something like this. Oh, that's not, yeah. So, how do we prove? Well, if you have that the x-ray transform of the function is zero, then you can define a u that solves the transport equation by sort of integrating the f along the geodesic flow. So with the only difference now that this xv is an arbitrary. An arbitrary element in SM. Yep. So you're defining the same formula, essentially. And the x-ray transform being equal to zero means that this on the plus vectors is zero. On the zero vectors is zero by definition. So this implies now that u is zero on SM, and by the fundamental theorem of calculus, xu is, I think it comes up to be minus F. So therefore, if this only depends on x, if you apply v, you get zero. Alright, so now you go back to Pesto and you see what happens. If I am on a simple manifold, this is greater than or equal to zero. I have yet to prove this, but I will do immediately. So this is greater than or equal to zero. This is zero, and then xu is equal to f, so therefore f is equal to zero. Very easy. So this is via Pesto. And for one forms, you can do something similar. You have to argue a little bit more to get the vanishing, but it's a bit more, not much. Okay, so to finally pay my debt in full, I only have to prove this, that on a simple manifold I have sign. Okay? There are different ways of doing that. But there's one way that I'm particularly fond of, and I will do it that way. So, proof of on a simple surface with a function vanishing on the boundary. So in fact, I'm going to prove a bit more. I'm going to prove this. If A is a solution to the Riccati equation, the Riccati equation xA plus A squared plus curvature equal to 0, then that term, in fact, can be computed precisely, which is sometimes useful if you want to get more information. It's actually another L2 norm. It's the L2 norm of so here this A is a function from Fm to R that solves the Riccati equation. This you always have precisely when you don't have conjugate points. When you don't have conjugate points, you actually have solutions of the Riccati equation. In fact, it is sort of equivalent. Yeah? So you don't have conjugate points along all the geodesics, so then you pick just a bunch of, you pick solutions of the Riccati equation along each of it, and you just glue them together. So this is really where the non-conjugate point condition comes here. This really, again, this is a sort of well-known fact in Riemannian geometry. I mean, the way you construct solutions from the Jacobi equation to the Riccati equation is, as many of you probably have learned in a basic ODE course, maybe you even lecture that to undergraduates. I mean, you have a solution of the Jacobi equation, y double dot plus ky equal to 0. The solution to the Riccati is y dot divided by y. So no conjugate points means that you can actually divide by y, basically. So that gives you a solution of the Riccati equation. Okay, so I just have to convince you of this. Yes, and then we'll have the right sign. Great, so I mean, there are other proofs of this using the Saint-Allo formula, but I mean, proofs that that thing has the right sign. And the nice thing about this one is that you get, you get an actual answer. I mean, you. Okay, and this is just a careful calculation. So it goes along the following line. So the fact that we have a VU is not important at all. So just to make the notation a little simpler, let me call VU psi. If VU vanishes on the boundary, then VU also vanishes on the boundary, because VU preserves, V preserves the boundary, differentiates in that direction. That's actually not true for X and X perp, yeah? So if X vanishes on the boundary and you do XU, then XU does not necessarily vanish on the boundary. But VU does. Very good. So what we need to prove then, which is completely general, is for any function psi, we're going to have this. Okay, and that just comes simply from computing this. So let's compute that term. Okay, so this is x plus a psi square minus 2 times the real part of the inner product of x plus a psi plus a square. It's very important here that A is real, so it comes out just fine. So when this term Certainly can be break into x psi psi plus a psi psi. Certainly, yeah? But A is a skew Hermitian matrix, so therefore this is purely imaginary. That's very nice. So purely imaginary, because A is skew Hermitian. So therefore, this the whole term boils down to that minus 2a real part of x psi psi, so the term with a in the middle is gone with capital A, yeah, plus a square. Okay, and now you want to use the Ricard equation. So how do you use the Ricard equation? Well, you just compute, this. If you differentiate a norm of psi square, you get xa psi square plus a, and the way you differentiate this is you're going to get twice that real part. Okay, so I think we have to collect terms now, so let's see. So the one on the left hand side has already appeared, and now I want to, it's an A, that's fine. So now I want to use the Ricard equation, which I, let me just remind you. Yes.
Yeah, so
this is an L. I'm getting ahead. You're absolutely right. So let me do it correctly. So, are you talking about this bit here? I'm jumping ahead of myself. Let's just not get it out yet, and I will write down immediately. So that's actually wrong. Apologies for that. So the way I should have done this is to, let me do it properly. It's going to be the same in the end, but let me just address exactly what you asked. Thanks for asking, because what I was saying was rubbish. So this is just this by definition. Yep. Thanks. Well, this is the usual inner product in Cn. Okay. And now I compute this separately. Thank you. And then it's going to come out all fine. But I mean, what I was doing was wrong. Absolutely. Okay, so that is and now the A can come out without any trouble point wise, yeah? I want that, let me call it like this, the one in Cn, yeah? Okay, good, and now x plus a psi psi is x psi psi plus, and this is now purely imaginary, I should have done everything point-wise, yeah. And now, if you differentiate that, you get that's okay now, so point-wise. XA plus that plus 2 times the real part of XA, XI, XI. And now using the Ricard equation, you can replace XA by minus A squared minus K psi squared plus 2A real part XA. Great. Okay, so now what you see is that if you put everything together is that that term ends up being x plus a psi square minus k psi square coming from here minus a full derivative. Okay? And now you integrate. So you integrate and then you get the two terms that you want, and that goes away because it's a full derivative with psi vanishing on the boundary. So we integrate to get the result using that sense now? Sorry for the confusion. X is a suggestive vector field. Oh, with respect to which metric? Oh, it's a Psaki metric. Why? No, for that you don't need killing. The only thing you need is volume preserving. This is what I explained before. Ah, okay. Now, yeah, I'm not even sure it is killing with respect to the Psaki metric. No, no, you only need volume preservation. Or, you know, in general, if you have a measure, and integrate the full derivative with respect to an invariant measure, that's always zero. Here you have boundary, but the whole point is that this works thanks to the fact that psi vanishes at the boundary. So it's, again, you know, the old integration by part thing. Okay, so yeah, so that's a proof. The sort of intuition for this lemma comes essentially from Riemannian geometry. I mean, in Riemannian geometry, when you deal with the index form on the loop space, yeah, so geodesics are critical points of the energy function. And having non-conjugate points is to say that by the index theorem, is to say that the energy function has a Hessian which is greater than or equal than zero. And that usually comes expressed in terms of an index form. And the index form usually looks like exactly like this, sort of, you know, some derivative along a geodesic and curvature. And usually integral versions of this, which in Riemannian geometry have been done just usually along geodesics, somehow still works out here. I mean, the traditional proof of this using the traditional, most it is not traditional, using the Santa Law formula, uses the Santa Law formula that was explained by Burago and Ivanov last week to decompose the integral in free space into integral along geodesics and identifying the integral along the geodesics with the index form in Riemannian geometry. But it can be done just as well with a solution of a global solution to the Descartes equation. Okay, so I'd like now to sort of this took me a little longer than expected, but that's fine. So I'd like to explain, begin sort of explaining today, how these things can be used to solve completely a tensor tomography problem for a simple surface. By that I mean, you know, up to now we've been essentially doing the rate transform of functions and one forms. Now I would like to do rate transform of tensors. Yeah? And there's an odd conjecture here. So the problem is the following. So you take, let's call it F, a symmetric M-tensor. Yeah. So basically, you know, before essentially we've been dealing with the cases M equals 0 and 1. So M equals 0 is a function, M equals 1, one form. Okay. Right. And if you have a symmetric M-tensor, you can consider the function that induces on SM. So I'm going to be looking, real-valued, just to make my life easy, real-valued symmetric M-tensor. So if you have a symmetric M-tensor, you can consider the function that it defines on the unit sphere bundle just by, you know, it's an M-tensor, so it has M entries. So you just do V, 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 M times. Therefore, you can do the usual X-ray transform, it's called IM, by integrating F along the geodesic lambda. Okay, so now, in this case, you take the XV. Okay, and what you would like to know.
When you look at M along the you look at F at different points, it's still the same metric. You know, like different parallels.
I'm not sure I follow. So if you look at F along different points.
F is just a metric.
Well, no, it's a real value tensor, taking values in R. So you, it's a, like if you have a two tensor, it's a symmetric bilinear form. I mean, but it's not, I mean, it's the matrix being applied to VV. Mm-hmm. So if you had a, if you
so that's because it depends on the trivial bundle. It's not curved. Otherwise, you need to translate it parallel.
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying, what you're asking. But I mean, maybe let me just write it in a slightly different form, perhaps to help. So at every point, so if you're moving along a geodesic, this is a tensor, sort of multilinear function at every point. Okay, so it changes with gamma t, and then the entries are all gamma dot, m times. Okay, and as such becomes a function of t that you can integrate without any problem.
If you look at on the arbitrary bundle, you can see there about forms, then you need to translate the parallels, right? If your bundle is not trivial.
Oh, are you thinking the case in which you consider tensors, vector value tensors,
yes,
on a vector bundle?
Yes.
Oh yeah, but that's okay, but I mean, so you want to take? Yeah. So no, I think this so traditional problem with that. But there's no bundle here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Keep on bundle and
Yes.
We have M-bundle.
Sure, I mean, in that case, the problem is that even the integral doesn't make sense somehow. Yeah, you could do parallel translation, yeah, okay, yes. Yes, I understand exactly what you're saying now. I don't even know if there are results in that setting. Yeah, I see now what you're asking. No, I'm taking a much more simple-minded approach here. This is just, you know, an arbitrary M tensor on M. Yeah. Okay, so the question that you would like to address is, you know, what's in the kernel? Of IM. For example, if you were dealing with one forms, any exact one form whose primitive vanishes on the boundary will give you zero. Or more generally, if you take H as symmetric M minus one tensor, you can look at what is called the derivative of the tensor, this sort of DH, which is you take the covariant derivative of the the Lebesgue beta, that gives you something that is not symmetric, then you symmetrize it. Yeah? Symmetrization. Then it's very easy to check that so this is a formula, okay, so this is something that needs to be checked, but it's just a calculation. But let me see if you understand, because I mean it could give rise to a sort of confusion. Here I'm sort of identifying loosely a symmetric tensor to its restriction to the unit tangent bundle, as I have explained before. So the meaning of this is that you take a symmetric M minus one tensor, you apply X, and that is the same thing as taking DH and taking the restriction to SM. And this is just a calculation. In the this is very similar to what I was saying before, that if you have H, a function that depends only on X, X of H is DH. This is the version for tensors. Okay. So therefore, anything any M plus one tensor, so this becomes now, this is an M tensor when you do the H. So any M tensor which is of the form DH is automatically in the kernel of the X-ray transform, provided that H vanishes on the boundary. So if this vanishes on the boundary, then I of DH is of course zero. So there's lots of stuff in the kernel, yeah? But this is, yeah? But the problem is then, you know, to show that this is the only stuff in the kernel. So the sort of problem is, the tensor tomography problem is, it's something like this. You take MG, a compact simple manifold, and the tensor tomography question is this. So if IMF is equal to zero, does this imply that F equals TH for H M minus one tensor with H being zero on the boundary? Yeah, because you know that trivially these things are in the kernel, but you want to show that these are the only ones in the kernel. With the understanding here, let me just say verbally, not write it down, that if M is equal to zero, you're just saying that F is equal to zero. Yeah, M minus one, minus one tensor doesn't make sense, so you're just understanding that F is identically zero. Yes. Yes.
Why is XH symmetric?
XH is not symmetric. H, so here, so, yeah. Let me pick a size. So the claim is this. So if H is a symmetric tensor, let big H be the function which is that. So the statement is that X of H, okay, and I hope that answers your question, yeah? So this is a function in SM, you differentiate it, you get a new function in SM. The new function in SM is the restriction to SM of D of that tensor, which is that. Okay, so this would be, so, but, you know, it gets very tiresome to kind of decorate everything with hats. It's kind of, the only thing you can do with a tensor in this sense is to restrict it, so at every stage, if you look at this, it's just the only thing that it could possibly mean. But yeah, I can understand that maybe a little bit confusing. Okay, so that's the tensor tomography problem. There are many reasons for being interested in this. For example, I'm sure you have heard this, but the case of two tensors is exactly what you get when you linearize the boundary rigidity problem. So if you make a linearization of the boundary rigidity problem, so a Riemannian metric, you know, the tangent space to Riemannian metrics are symmetric tensors. So you do a deformation, and it boils down to this. So if you want to show, for example, the linear version of the boundary rigidity problem, so you have to answer this for m equals 2. Okay, but then apparently, and I say this apparently because I really don't know that much about this, but the case of m equals 4 is also interesting, has applications in elasticity. And for more on this, the reference is Sharafutdinov's book. Now, the theorem that I will explain tomorrow is a positive answer to that question when m is a surface. So, the theorem is the answer to the tensor tomography is yes for of m equals 2. Okay. And, okay, so we'll explain that tomorrow. So let me just then finish today by simply telling you a little bit about history. There's a lot in this question. So let me tell you what was known. So the case of functions, which I explained, the case of functions I did explain to you, well, in dimension 2, but it's the same proof in any dimensions. The case of functions was proved by Mukhometov in 77, but it was done for all dimensions. The case of n equals to 1, which is the case of one forms, was done by Anikonov and Romanov. And the first published proof, I understand, is only from 97, but it was done a lot earlier, apparently. So, uh, Okay, and then for the case of two tensors, Shafuddinov. Oh, yes, thanks very much. All dimensions. Thank you. For N equals 2, Shafuddinov in 2007 proved it for surfaces, yeah? And surfaces. Now, his proof is very involved. It uses the solution to the linear problem, to the boundary rigidity problem, to prove this, which is completely crazy, yeah? You would imagine it should be the other way around. Somehow. So it's a very nice but long paper where he takes one parameter families of digits, he essentially linearizes the digital to Neumann map along a family of metrics and studies the variations of the digital to Neumann map. And by doing that and using the solution to the nonlinear problem by Pester-Ullmann, he's able to show this. Which I think is. So the proof of our theorem is a completely different proof from Shafuddinov, in a way. And then finally, Pester and Shafuddinov have, and this you can find in Shafuddinov's book, prove the result with curvature assumptions for arbitrary n. But any dimension. And this, again, can all be found in Shafuddinov's book, essentially. And a lot of other stuff is known. I mean, it's known that if there are ghosts, they can only be form a finite dimensional space. So there is more work. I'm not being sort of exhaustive here. There is quite a lot of work on this question. So the question dates back roughly from, the question is from about 88, the tensor tomography one. Okay, so maybe this is a good place to stop. So what I'll do then tomorrow, at least for half of the lecture, is I'm going to explain the proof of this, which essentially, we will be able to quickly reduce it to a transport equation, as we've done for the case of functions. And the idea is going to attenuate the transport equation and use a holomorphic integrating factor again to be able to deal with that. Okay? So I'll explain that tomorrow. It's not that involved, given that I think we've done most of the difficult work. And then in the remaining of the lectures, I will discuss it. Whatever I can for the closed case. Yes. So it's, they don't use exactly this Pester identity. They use variation. So it's, maybe I should say that what I've been calling the Pester identity is it's a variation of the usual Pester identity. Yes, but they essentially use the curvature to control the signs on the we take care of, we don't actually control the curvature. You'll see tomorrow. There are two ways of doing it. I'm going to just explain one way. It's more like, uses ideas in some sense with holomorphicity only, in a way. Knowing that you have injectivity, it's like a ladder. The basic result, is injectivity in zero functions and one forms. That's kind of a basic thing, and then we are sort of building up on that. That's really what we're doing. So the Pester identity is being used there for functions and one forms to begin with. Okay. Okay.
Okay. No. Do you know what this is about?
cover of the rack. It just is on the arbitrary bundle, so I don't know bundle can be. It's not simple. It's really a different problem.
Okay, yes.
So
then, sorry, we're in question.
Yes, so it's not very risky. But okay, it's very risky. It's for that this ID.
Okay.
But it's, yeah, you're right. It's a time dependent. It's IDDT.
Okay, great.